Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
So, one nation under God. Not. You heard a bit of the story of the Pledge of Allegiance from Johanna Seal. And I want to add a little more to that story. Francis Bellamy was a Baptist minister. And as a good Baptist, he strongly believed in the separation of church and state. In the establishment of the Constitution, it wasn't just the deists like Jefferson or the small religious groups, but the Baptists, who were numerous in some parts of the colonies, but very much minorities in others, but who had come out of a tradition of separation of church and state in rebellion themselves against the earlier forms of the Reformation that it took, which were alliances with the state. So Francis Bellamy was a strong advocate of the separation of church and state. He was also, living in the 1890s, reacting to what was going on in culture and society at the time. This was a time of a huge amount of immigration into this country. Much of it, but not all of it, from Northern Europe, but some of it from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe as well. It was a time when it was clear that this country was becoming something other than a predominantly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation. And Bellamy, like many people of that kind of background, found it challenging. But he also found challenging the Gilded Age, which is what we call that time of immense concentration of wealth among a small number of industrialists and increasing impoverishment of people of ordinary means, both middle class and working class people, because of the concentration of wealth. And he was also a little scared of the immigration and thought it should be restricted. He was a founding member, however, of the Society of Christian Socialists. Now, Christian socialists believed that there had to be a more equitable distribution of wealth and resources in this country than the open market of its time was allowing to happen. So he's a Baptist, a strict church-state separationist, fearful of increased immigration, and a believer that the economic system as it functioned was unjust to most people. He was an avid supporter of public education as a way of integrating different cultures together, as well as assuring a competent and capable electorate in a democracy. He also supported what he called the nationalization of business, which meant basically socialization of the means of production. And his cousin, the famous Edward Bellamy, wrote a book called Looking Backward, which was a socialist utopian novel that is still assigned in schools to this day, even though we're past the year that he set the future in when he wrote it. And that novel, interestingly enough, had religious pluralism as a part of it too. So Francis Bellamy was an interesting character. And as a writer for Youth's Companion, a religious magazine for young people, which also sold flags, he had a double incentive, a multiple incentive, to write the version of the Pledge of Allegiance that he wrote. The sale of flags became very popular, and this magazine supported its publication in part by selling flags through the mail. So partly the Pledge of Allegiance was to get flags used more. It was a campaign to get a flag on every school building. But it was also a campaign to integrate disparate populations through education into a common culture. So there's a whole lot behind the Pledge of Allegiance. And none of it is promoting the United States as a Christian nation, even though he was a Christian. But as a Baptist, a staunch supporter of church-state separation. Oh, and one more thing. 1892, the year he introduced his version of the pledge, was the 400th anniversary of Columbus's landing on these shores. And there are all kinds of celebrations. And he was connecting it with that as well, and the integration of, as I said, of disparate peoples into one. So he put it out there, and it became very popular, unlike the earlier one by the Civil War veteran that you heard from Johanna. But these are the words. I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. No God there. But that was how it was originally written and stood that way until 1954, when under God was added. And it was added in part because of a movement that developed in response, in oppositional response to many of the things Bellamy supported and stood for, and to many of the progressive era reforms that Republican presidents such as Theodore Roosevelt promoted, like the what they called trust busting, which is the breaking up of monopolies. And this movement was called Christian Libertarianism. Well, you have Christian socialists, you have Christian libertarians.
Yeah.
And it developed during the latter part of Bellamy's lifetime in opposition to one of the developments of the early 1900s and late 1800s, the social gospel. And this was something Bellamy wasn't directly involved in, though the great thinker of the social gospel was Walter Rauschenbusch, another Baptist minister, who put forth a theology that was adopted by Christians of many denominations, that it was their work not to focus on individual salvation, but on the salvation of society through transformation of the economy and the social structures. Now, some of them were socialists, some of them weren't, but they were all committed to, as Bellamy was, building a unified and fair society. Rauschenbusch himself was a minister of a Baptist church in what was then called Hell's Kitchen. I think it has a more she-she name now to most people. That was largely attended by immigrants. It was, in fact, a largely German-language Baptist church in that neighborhood. So we had the social gospel, and Rauschenbusch was just the best-known exponent of it. That spread across the country. There was a large movement for peace in this country after the horrors of what they called the Great War, what we know as the First World War. And this was all scary to the owners of large businesses. Oh, and yes, the income tax was instituted during the First World War as well. A lot was going on that was scary to those people who had built huge empires of wealth during the Gilded Age and to other owners of great wealth and corporations in the country. So groups such as the National Association of Manufacturers and the United States Chamber of Commerce tried to put together campaigns to oppose the social gospel, and then beginning in 1933 to oppose the New Deal. And the strategy that they came up with a big input from a Congregationalist minister in Los Angeles named James Fifield, was the notion of promoting the United States as a Christian nation and free market capitalism as the proper Christian form of society. It was not a new idea, but they were promoting it both in opposition to the New Deal, also in opposition to the newly formed Soviet Union, but in opposition to the social gospel, which had brought liberal thinking about society even into many evangelical and theologically conservative churches around the country. So the United States Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, heard, particularly the National Association, at their annual dinner at the Waldorf Astoria in 1940, a talk by the Reverend James W. Fifield, Jr., senior minister of the First Congregational Church of Los Angeles, which he went to in 1924, fresh out of Chicago Divinity School, and built up from a congregation of 450 to over 4,000, including many of the Protestant leaders of the entertainment industry. You know, a lot of that industry was Jewish, but he had Cecil B. DeMille and that gang in his congregation, the Protestants in the film industry, and the wealthy ones. And the absolute opposite of Walter Rauschenbusch, this became an upper-class church, and he formed on the basis of that a group called Spiritual Mobilization to oppose the spread of socialism, to oppose criticism of business, and to join in the opposition to the New Deal. In 1940, he was a guest speaker at the annual meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, and he electrified the audience, and owners of large corporations started pouring money into his efforts and funding this and other groups seeking to talk about, to make America be identified as a Christian nation in which the free market was the manifestation of the teachings of the Bible. I will note that Francis Bellamy was pushed out of one church because he kept referring to Jesus as a socialist. And he was not the only preacher to do that time. The Universalist, one Universalist minister did that repeatedly. But he wasn't selling flags. He also worked as a union organizer. So this big movement with lots of funding, with magazines such as Faith and Freedom, which was published by Spiritual Mobilization and which Fifield also edited, youth programs, getting ministers to pledge for Americanism, for free markets, and for opposition to union organizing. Thousands around the country joined in this. And then others who were allied with this did things like started organizing prayer breakfasts for members of Congress. The famous prayer breakfast in Washington, including what's now the White House prayer breakfast, started as part of this movement of Christian libertarianism. So you heard in brief the story of the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, pull out a dollar bill if you have anything that small. And under the big one on the back, it says, "In God we trust." And it's even smaller letters over the picture of the White House on the 20. In God we trust. There had been some coinage with that on it, but it wasn't a national policy. It was a design decision from time to time, depending on who was running the mint. But efforts had begun in the 1860s to put the phrase "In God we trust" on money. Why "In God we trust"? Think of the national anthem, "And this be our motto, and God is our trust." People wanted to spread that. Some of them just honest, well-meaning Christians and veterans of the Civil War, but it really got momentum with this Christian libertarian movement. There was a big push during Roosevelt, the first Roosevelt's administration, Theodore, 1901-1909, to put "In God we trust" on money. Now, Theodore Roosevelt, who was a believing Christian and a regular churchgoer, he was raised Dutch Reformed, but he usually attended Episcopal churches because his wife was Episcopalian. But, you know, he was very clear that he had a set of beliefs that he had learned growing up in the Reformed Church, and these informed, you know, his life. And he responded, and I quote here, "My own firm conviction is that such a motto on coins not only does no good, but positive harm, and is in effect irreverence, which comes close to sacrilege." That is, from his perspective as a Christian who happened to be the President of the United States, was that putting and God we trust on money was actually an assault on the integrity of his own faith. Nonetheless, there was pressure, and it eventually appeared on money, but over at least one president's objections. 1953 to 1954, this whole movement was building up, with at that point the support of the White House. Who was president? Dwight David Eisenhower, the first president of the United States to be baptized during his term of office. He had been raised very loosely in a Christian church in Kansas, but had never joined a church or been baptized. So shortly after being inaugurated, he was baptized at the big Presbyterian church in Washington, where many of the presidents had gone to services, including Lincoln. And he had at his inauguration something unusual, a prayer that he wrote and delivered. He saw part of his role as bringing religion into politics. And this was important to Eisenhower. In fact, he started a practice of beginning all the cabinet and staff meetings with prayers, something that had never been done before. Even in the darkest days of the Civil War and the First World War. And in fact, it was quoted one day as coming out of a meeting, realizing he'd forgotten the prayer and sputtering, "Jesus Christ, we forgot the prayer." Well, he was career military. He could be profane as well. And these various groups affiliated with Christian libertarianism promoted this and promoted it in the public. Though the bill that actually brought "In God We Trust" to the currency was a bill filed by a Catholic in the House of Representatives. And the Protestants had been pushing it for years, had to be convinced to get out of the way because this bill was getting momentum, and they were going to have to put their egos on the side and let this Catholic congressman, you know, in a time that this country still thought of itself as being largely Protestant, have his name on it. And so money went on the dollar bill, money went on stamps, money went on currency, all around 1954. And then you had the Pledge of Allegiance. And as part of this whole, gosh, dare we say, mishigas of our nation, we got God on our money, God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and so on and so forth. But their whole goal, the whole goal of Christian libertarians was to convince people this was a Christian nation and completely free markets were the only way to be Christian. And that is something that Christians, including Adam Smith, disagreed with when he wrote his great books on capitalism in this 18th century. He didn't believe free markets were always the best way to organize every aspect of the economy, even though he became the first person to really explain well how free markets worked. So what, is it a Christian nation, isn't it? Well, there's no doubt that U.S. civil society as we know it has deep roots in religion. You know, many of our early settlements were established with churches. I mean, the Congregationalists of New England, you know, a church in the middle of town, it was also the town meeting house, and everyone had to pay taxes to support it. Protestantism dominated in the English-speaking colonies, though there's a Catholic church in St. Augustine that's older than any of the Protestant churches in the United States now. That was an earlier church established by Spanish Catholic settlers in an earlier colony. And that really helped shape the society, and there's no denying that. Does that make it theologically Christian? No. It's a radical wing of the Reformation, the Calvinists, the Congregationalists, the Baptists, who all believed that individual human beings had a direct relationship with God. It didn't go through a whole church hierarchy. and their congregations were democratically organized, though different particular structures amongst the Presbyterians or the Congregationalists, but all with an element of democratic organization. And in fact, church membership in the British colonies was under 20% before the Revolution. Under 20%. Now, some of that's because there just weren't any churches in some of the areas. But even in the developed town and settled towns, even where in New England they had to pay taxes to support the church, lots of people didn't actually join the church. By 1910, that had increased to 43% church membership. 49 in 1940, 57 in 1950, and it peaked at 69% in 1960 and has been declining since. So not until around 1950 were a majority of Americans members of churches or synagogues. They were counting synagogues at that point. There were some Buddhist temples here then. I don't think they got counted. Did it surpass 50% of the population? And it peaked at just under 70%. And it was only during the Eisenhower administration that the Christian libertarians' ideas were adopted by the White House. This gave an impetus to people to be openly religious, and religion became an ally of the Cold War against the Soviet Union. There were lots of reasons why these happened, but the notion that America is a Christian nation and its very nature tied to free market capitalism was put forth by a group of business people through the early and mid-20th century, and it's all documented in this book, One Nation Under God, by Kevin Cruz, who teaches history at Princeton University, and the development since, which we're not going into today. And that whole Eisenhower era, where we developed what a lot of people very serious about religion called an American civil religion, which they thought wasn't really very serious religion at all, but more of a ceremonial kind of religion. And the ACLU didn't initially oppose adding under God to the statute, to the Pledge of Allegiance, because they just thought it was empty language. It became more troublesome later. But I would say that the United States is definitely not one nation under God, however you want to define that God, even defining it expansively. For even among religious people, there is an immense diversity of belief. Among Christians, from fundamentalists on one end to liberals on the other. On an interesting side note, James Fifield, the Congregationalist minister who helped start all of this, was considered rather not appropriately orthodox in his theology, or as one of his wealthy parishioners said, "I'm doubtful of his doctrine on the Trinity." It's a good thing, though, he was there, not a couple blocks away at the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles, where there were a lot of communists. But even among religious liberals, even among religious people, there's great diversity. All three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have been in this country virtually from the beginning. And we sometimes forget that the native peoples had their religions before the European ancestors arrived. And in spite of the efforts of the Europeans to convert them all to one form of Christianity or another, the native faiths never disappeared, or practices disappeared completely, and have had a real rebirth over the last half century or so. African religions and Islam came with slavery and were never completely wiped out amongst the slaves. There are customs that you see in African-American Christian churches now that derive from Native African religions or Islam that have been adapted. And there are small pockets here and there of people who remember bits of that through the generations. And now again, African religions have had a rebirth over the last half century. And people are recalling their ancestral memories and reaffirming them. Religions originating in Asia and Africa have grown with immigration and the reclaiming of culture and tradition by descendants of slaves and other ancestral immigrants. And this all received a boost in 1893 when the first World Parliament of World Religions was held in Chicago. And this is also to mark the 400th anniversary of Columbus landing on these shores, but it took him a little longer to organize it. We had the World Columbian Exposition, which was like a World's Fair in Chicago to mark it. And in 1893, the second year of the exposition, you had the Parliament of World's Religions, which brought people of faith from around the world, including Africa and India and East Asia, to the United States to meet in dialogue. And although it was a Swedenborgian who kicked it off, Unitarians ran it. Jenkin Lloyd Jones, who is Frank Lloyd Wright's uncle and the Unitarian minister in Chicago, was one of the leaders. And several Universalist women played prominent roles in it as well. So, and at that time, the idea of different religions got a new legitimacy. They were being discussed and celebrated at a high level and nationally in the society. And Vedanta, as a particular form of Hinduism, was introduced to this country at that time because one of its great leaders coming here for the parliament and then staying several years and establishing schools and groups around the United States. And all along, in spite of there are all these religious differences, and there are records of, by the way, of Muslims being in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War and during the Civil War. Not many, but some. And there's been a strain of rationalism in this country from day one. Even among the conservative Congregationalists, the Calvinists, they were highly educated people interested in science. And they applied reason to everything, even if they came to different conclusions than others might. And they promoted science, and rationalism has always been a part of American religious culture. And one scholar has suggested that there was more in common among the educated people of the colonies, whatever their religious faith, around religion, than there was about almost anything else, even though they belonged to different churches. But they all had this rationalist and highly literate way of approaching it. So we have an election coming up. Oh, yeah, and we also have the growth of the nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S. The nuns, N-U-N-S, are in decline. But the nuns and the spiritual but not religious, who pick up all sorts of strains of Eastern religions and secular philosophical practices and make us not a uniform country at all. Well, United States citizens of varied religions and none will vote on Tuesday, and some will vote based on the directions of their pastors. No one would do that here, so I'm not even going to tell you anything about how I'm voting. But some do. And some will listen and disagree with their pastors. And within the Roman Catholic Church, some people will vote a hard line against anyone who supports abortion in any way, shape, or form, and others will weigh their votes based on the Catholic social teachings on economic justice, which are also very strong and probably held as widely in the Catholic Church as any teachings on abortion are. There will be evangelical Christians who will ally themselves with Christian libertarianism in large numbers, and there will be others who will assert inclusivity and Jesus' teachings on justice and forgiveness. And I went and looked this week on the website of the First Congregational Church of Los Angeles, and their current minister used to be interim associate minister at Riverside Church in New York City. And they are now doing same-sex weddings and promoting economic justice. And I couldn't find James Fifield's name mentioned anywhere on the website. So, but there, you know, people will go out there. They will vote. They will make their decisions. And we come to the call to action. I'll make some suggestions about how you make your decisions, but not what those decisions should be.